When Hamlet told a friend, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy," he made an understatement for the ages. And the words become truer with every astronomical discovery. What are we finding out there in the seemingly limitless universe? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Well, for starters, there are white dwarfs, neutron stars, and black holes. How do we find them, and how do we track their development, which can go on for billions of years? With me is Marina Orio, senior scientist with the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy and research professor at the Italian National Institute of Astrophysics at Padova Observatory. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Now, these three things, which at first glance look to be very dissimilar, black holes, neutron stars, and white dwarfs, do have one big thing in common, I guess, and that's how extremely compact they are.
Yeah, they're compact in different, very different ways. What they have in common is that they're the final stage of a star. And the most common are, of course, the white dwarfs. Well, not of course, but as I will explain, these are the white dwarfs, the most common. And we usually discover them only because of, if they're far away, we discover them because they have a companion, the white dwarfs, whereas black holes can almost only be discovered if they have some matter around, because they are black, as the name says.
They're not putting out any light for us to see.
So in terms of dimensions, if you think of a white dwarf has a radius that is comparable to the one of the Earth, but with a mass that is comparable to the one of the Sun. And we're talking about thousands of kilometers or thousands of miles. A mile is 1.6 kilometers, right? So the same order of magnitude, at least for us astronomers. It doesn't, the factor of 1.6 is not so important. Neutron stars have radii that are similar to the ones of the Earth. So they are, white dwarfs are comparable to the Earth. Neutron stars are much smaller, about 1,000 times smaller in size
than the Earth.
Yeah. So they, you know, they have radii of all the orders of 10 kilometers or a few miles. And the black hole is an infinite small thing, something that we cannot even figure out. So we can only think in terms of the last radius where we can see matter around it, if there is matter around it, and that's the so-called Schwarzschild radius, from the name of a German physicist in the early 20th century. And that's where, in practice, the matter that is sucked inside the black hole would have to exceed the speed of light, which the theory of relativity proved is impossible.
Right.
So the radius, the Schwarzschild radius, is like the radius at which the matter would already be at the speed of light. And that's of the order of, again, of the order of magnitude of a neutron star, but there can be a much, much, much larger mass inside, but it's infinitely small. It's something we cannot even conceive.
A black hole. Is infinitely small. And yet it can pull in everything that comes within...
That comes through the Schwarzschild radius. So the escape velocity from the black hole would exceed the speed of light, so that cannot be exceeded, and so... So
what goes into a black hole doesn't come out.
Anything around it doesn't. Well, there are theories that show that there could be some radiation. Mm-hmm. You may have heard of Stephen Hawking and things like that.
Yes, Hawking radiation, yeah.
But those are complicated theories, mm-hmm. and there is no experimental observational proof. It's so in practice we can say that we can think of it as something from which nothing can come out.
So is the black hole the densest thing we know of in the universe?
Right.
And a black hole could be smaller than a marble, smaller. It doesn't have dimensions.
Oh, no. It doesn't have dimensions in our way of thinking. It is infinitely small.
How does it get that way?
So, first of all, we can start maybe to explaining what happens when you form a white dwarf. So that would be the first stage of compactness, so to speak. And that's what happens in the core of a star. So most stars have masses that are less than 8 times the mass of the sun. And we calculated something like, when I say we, I mean astronomers in general, they are always improving it, but they calculated an initial mass function that shows that the mass of the stars is the number of stars in a certain with a certain mass is proportional to that mass. So the smallest stars are the most, the less massive, less heavy stars are the most common. So a large majority of stars will have masses of less than 8 solar masses. And they all undergo thermonuclear burning if they exceed the number of times, let's say, the mass of Jupiter. Jupiter will not is not an object that can ignite the thermonuclear burning. But with a certain mass, the object can contract enough and become hot and dense enough to start thermonuclear burning in the interior. And there is a series of burnings that can happen, but at some point, nuclear burning will not produce energy, and the core, because you can, once you synthesize iron, you don't have other types of nuclear burnings that produce enough energy to sustain the core of the star that collapses. That doesn't collapse. It's already extremely dense. It becomes it's a plasma in which it's a plasma in which you have electrons that move freely, like in a metal, we can say, through conduction, and it's very dense. So as we said, it would have a radius of only few thousands of kilometers, and containing a very large mass, can be the order of the mass of the sun, or less or more, but a good portion of the,
maybe smaller than the Earth, but with the same amount of density mass as the sun,
right,
which is what, about a million times the size of the Earth.
Right. So it will be extremely condensed, and that is what will constitute the white dwarf afterwards. The star loses its exterior layers that haven't undergone nuclear burnings, and often that happens because many stars are in binaries, and so there are
two star systems
that are either born together or captured each other through gravitation. And so the envelope of the star will be lost, and large part of the mass will be in this core, and this core constitutes the white dwarf. And the white dwarf is just is so extremely compact, because it is this very compact core that has contracted and ignited the nuclear burning, which requires a high density to start, and a high temperature, of course. And it will become cooler and cooler, and becoming something like a crystal. And at some point, very interesting things can happen, and there can be explosions, either on the surface or eventually thermonuclear explosions as a supernova. But I will talk about it a little bit later. So we go to what is a neutron star. If you get to a certain mass, which is about 1.4 the mass of the sun, we astronomers think in terms of the mass of the sun for comparisons. At that point, you will have something that is not a configuration that is not sustainable as a As a white dwarf, it won't just be a plasma with ions and electrons moving freely, but you can think that these ions will not will be packed together and will only get neutrons. So.
So a plasma, when you use that term plasma, is that subatomic particles that are just kind of unassociated?
Yeah, the term plasma intend a hot and dense gas usually. It can be many different things, but when you have a neutron star, it's not exactly what we usually call plasma. It's just neutrons at that point. There is no space to have electrons and protons and neutrons, separate particles. Everything will, a proton and an electron will become a neutron, right? So the neutron star will collapse at that point, and it will be so much denser, about 1,000 times denser than the white dwarf. And that happens either because you have it is the end of a star that has a mass of more than about 8 solar masses, approximately. Often, not often, but always, as a ending as a supernova. So the core collapses because it's not sustained by nuclear burning anymore. But there is no further burning that can produce energy at that point to sustain gravity. And so there is this collapse into a neutron star.
Maybe we can do a short detour here to look at how a star develops in the first place. And then that will give us a sense of these stages in the later development of the star, or you want to say the ultimate end of the star even. So do stars come out of plasma in the first place, or how do they develop?
Stars come out of gas. There is a lot of gas in many galaxies. Even to these days, there are still galaxies that are forming stars, and little by little, there will be phenomena that can allow condensations that will eventually become stars. Dust will be formed, so there will be grains, and usually that's where we find star formation. Some molecules will be, so the gas can be cold enough to have molecules, and they can aggregate in what we call grains. And in this gas, usually you can have these condensations that eventually will become stars. But the star formation process is complex, and it's always it's constantly studied because it's a very interesting process. And
what elements are we talking about in these gas clouds?
It depends on the on whether it's the first generation of stars or not. So what we think is that the universe had only primordial universe had only very light elements. So there was hydrogen and
helium,
about 27% or so, and then 70% hydrogen. I'm saying just rough numbers, and then some very actually it's in the local universe that we have 27% helium. At that point, you would have had, you start just practically with hydrogen, and you have some very light elements like lithium, deuterium. So the only one you can produce without stars is helium. And all the other elements are, we are the ashes of stars, even our body, everything we see, they're produced in stars, right? So once you form the first stars in these clouds that have condensations, you will be able to start synthesizing heavier elements. And it's a little bit of a mystery why it's so hard to find stars that are so to speak pure first generation. They're difficult to First of all, they may be in very ancient galaxies, but
right.
in any case, they're difficult to detect. But what we think is that mostly they could be much more massive, much bigger than this than the maximum star mass we have nowadays. So you could have formed really heavy, sort of big stars, much more than the eight solar masses that I was talking about before. So that's how a star formed, and then the star. I made it simple, but it's much more complicated, of course. But once you formed the star, you start burning hydrogen in the core of the star. It won't be possible to do it in the whole star, but the center will contract and will ignite thermonuclear burning. And then the first thing that you can form is helium from two protons. You have nuclear burning that produces helium, but there are more complicated burnings that can occur. There is a very if the environment is hot enough, you can have a peculiar way of burning hydrogen that produces all sorts of side reactions that produce other elements, and so you start producing some elements of intermediate atomic number.
Intermediate, you mean between two elements?
Well, once you have other elements in the second generation of stars, when you burn hydrogen, when I say intermediate, I mean intermediate in the periodic table.
Right, yeah, right.
So you'll be able to produce elements even while there is hydrogen burning in these second generation of stars. If they're massive enough, you will be able to produce at some point also calcium, aluminum, other chlorine. You're actually creating elements.
Develops.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than just, you know, hydrogen produces helium and so on and so forth. In any case, the second big burning is the burning of helium, and you will produce carbon, and then you will be able to produce hydrogen, neon. But once you have iron, you won't be able to burn anything that allows you to fight the collapse of the star. And that's why stars that are more massive than eight solar masses, they have been dense enough to ignite all the nuclear burnings that are possible. And even there are stages when they burn in a shell. So burning is not just one cycle after the other in the core. At some point, they start burning around the core, and then they ignite the next burning in the core. So that often happens with helium, and that's when a star expands, becomes a red giant. It's because it has exhausted one burning, but then it will start burning in a shell, and the envelope is still expanded, but then it will be able to have enough to produce enough energy to allow the next burning in the core. And so it's the life of a star is relatively complicated, but there is a path in what we call the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, a diagram that shows the luminosity and the radius and the temperature of the star. So it will change radius during its life. It will become, after the hydrogen burning, it will always expand into what we call is a red giant. So
sure.
It will be much cooler and much larger dimension. And so these burnings continue, but if the star is larger than eight solar masses, its core will collapse into a neutron star or a black hole, and it will become a supernova that ejects all the rest of the gas around it.
Just for example, then you're talking about neutron star forming with eight or more solar masses in density, but if we look at our own. Is it a yellow dwarf, a yellow R star of the sun?
Right, yes, it's a yellow dwarf.
And so obviously it has one solar mass. In a nutshell, what is the future of the sun?
It's a white dwarf. And since it Most likely because it doesn't have a companion, there will not be for it an occasion to have a further life and explode as a nova or supernova. But white dwarfs can have a second life.
But it will expand?
It will, once hydrogen is exhausted in the core, it will expand to a red giant.
And that would take it up where, to the orbit of Jupiter or someplace?
It will, it will engulf its planets. I have to think if it is if it goes beyond Jupiter, but for sure it will get to Jupiter in radius.
Far enough.
Far enough. And so I think it's it will should be able to burn to have the next burning, but then after that I think they will all, the last stage will be the. The white dwarf, possibly.
Where it will just kind of peel away.
So there is a maximum mass for each burning, the maximum mass of the core. And so the next burning after hydrogen is helium burning, formation of carbon. So most of the white dwarfs we see are of carbon and oxygen. But strangely enough, there are some that are only of helium. And if we calculate the lifetime of burning of hydrogen for a small mass star that would end only as a helium white dwarf, that time should be longer than the age of the universe.
Which gets a little tricky to predict.
Yeah, so if we have white dwarfs of helium, we understand that it should be because of binary evolution, because they have lost mass to a binary companion during their life, or they must have lost a lot of mass and become smaller. Because otherwise, if they were born like that, they would still be burning. Because the smaller the mass is, the longer the burning is. So a white dwarf of helium shouldn't be created without any particular phenomena that alter its mass, because it would still be burning. It would be a small mass one. So. Kind of funny that we make all these predictions and then we have data that show things are a bit different and more complicated than we have to justify.
With about a 12 billion year timeline for this evolution, it's not been observed yet then?
No.
Not in its entirety?
No. So, and then we were asking about, we don't really know when a black hole is formed and how, but many black holes are of stellar mass. There are other black holes that are much heavier than, in the center of galaxies, the so-called galactic nuclei.
Right.
Most of them are active, and being active means that they have attract material around, that they emit, they have hot plasma, they emit X-rays, they emit radio radiation. So those are of millions of solar masses. They can be of any dimension, really. But the funny thing is that we don't observe black holes of intermediate masses between, say, 100 solar masses and 100,000 or something like that. So this range, we don't know why they don't form, but possibly because these are two completely different types of objects. So one comes from congregation of many massive stars in the centers of galaxies from a collapse emerging, maybe. There are theories, but it's still being studied. And the other ones are just the end product of the life of a star.
Let's look further at the phenomena, black holes and neutron stars and white dwarfs, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Marina Orio, who is telling us about black holes and neutron stars and white dwarfs, these remarkably compact celestial phenomena, and some similarities but some differences too among them. But I want to touch first on something that you said a little while ago, Marina, and that has to do with we haven't seen any first-generation stars yet. We haven't seen any stars that are not recycled material?
We think we're actually thinking now that we are detecting the end products of those stars through gravitational waves. So it turns out, for some reason that has not been explained well yet, that if you heard about these LIGO, Virgo experiments, these wonderful and extremely successful, after so much work, gravitational wave detectors that we have on Earth that work with lasers that can detect minimal perturbations in the in faraway objects due to gravity. We detect merging black holes, merging neutron stars, or the merging of a neutron star or a black hole in a binary system. And the theory of relativity, of general relativity, is so elegant and so precise that it can predict with a relatively simple formula from the signal, from the frequency that is detected, you can predict exactly, understand exactly what the mass of these merging objects is. And so we're finding many massive black holes that are still of stellar dimensions, so to speak, but they must be of the order of 80, 100 solar masses, and that would be, mostly 20, 30, but that would correspond to stars of 100 solar masses, 120, depending on the mass of the remnant, which is the black hole. So the initial mass of the star, of those stars, must have been very, very large. And so we think that they, the nuclear burning and the, can be supported, that those stars can live only if they were the initial stars. They didn't have any heavy elements. These are calculations of chemistry and physics that show that. And so somehow we are detecting the remnants of these primordial stars that were more massive. They didn't have to all to be so massive, but at least we are detecting the remnants of some of them. Otherwise, it's really difficult to discover first-generation stars in external galaxies. But the black holes that we discover through the effects that they have in binary stars, where they're sucking matter from a companion, not the central black holes of galaxies, the very heavy ones, but the stellar masses one that we detect so through light, through in different wavelengths, through electromagnetic radiation, they tend to be not more than 10 solar masses, and possibly their progenitor star wasn't as large as the ones that we detect through gravitational waves, which is a little bit of a mystery why the gravitational waves discover only the massive ones and the electromagnetic waves discover only the non-massive ones.
It would be a mystery to me.
And so that's one of the things scientists are working on to try and explain.
Well, let's do kind of a rough illustration, if we can. And if we get in our spaceship and approach each of these three phenomena, what would be the experience?
Oh, so, well, the effective gravity, the gravity that you would experience on the white dwarf would be terribly high. So,
so you would get pulled toward it because it's so dense, you would get pulled right to it from a great distance.
So I don't know what would, if you die or what, at what point, but we're talking about effective gravity that is orders of magnitudes much larger than what we have on Earth. So I don't think it would be very...
Not comfortable.
I don't think we can get very close.
And how about a neutron star?
A neutron star, I think there would be even relativistic effects before you get to it. And as you... we have to think in four dimensions of space-time, and things will be... you will be like in a different... even before you get close to the neutron star, you will be in a different space-time, so to speak. You may be experiencing different phenomena of aging, or I don't know, it depends on where exactly you are. The black hole, you cannot, I mean, you will be sucked in at some point. First of all, the gravity will be tremendously high. You will die for sure. Well, I think you'll die also if you get too close to the white dwarf or neutron star, but I don't know at what distance, at what point. I never thought about the effect it would have on the living organism. But with the black hole, it would be, you would never return if you get too close. So.
Now, the black hole has an event horizon, which the other two, the neutron star and the white dwarf, don't.
No, the neutron star and white dwarfs have surfaces. They have their real stars, their objects that we can touch. But because of the gravity is so high, I don't think that you would be able to fly to them.
You wouldn't be able to get out. But the event horizon in a black hole is that.
That's where, as I said, the escape velocity from the velocity necessary to take off from there would be larger than the velocity of light, the speed of light, which we cannot exceed. Nothing can exceed the speed of light.
So it sounds as if something needs to be worked out there.
Yeah, you will be into the infinite small that we cannot describe with.
In all three of these phenomena, the white dwarf, the neutron star, the black hole, we are observing them not directly, but through their effect on things around them?
Well, white dwarfs we observe also directly. The ones nearby, we can observe directly as they're cooling. Even if they're not burning, we still observe them because they are still luminous. And they have peculiar atmospheres, peculiar spectra, and we know that they are white dwarfs. So through a mixture of some photometry, some measurements of the light they emit in every band, but also through spectra, through the measuring their spectral lines. Is that clear enough?
Yes, the
diffraction of light.
The light, yes.
Yeah, the light that comes from different elements, from different atomic transitions. We understand that their atmosphere is very relatively simple, as we expect from a white dwarf, and we know they're white dwarfs. So this is very well understood.
You can literally see them. You can see the
literally
spectrum
see
of light that they throw out.
Farther away, you see them because of the other phenomena due to binary stars. But close enough, you see them even if they are isolated, single, not married. Neutron stars, instead, there is actually a neutron star, for instance, that was called by Italian astronomers Geminga in Milanese dialect, because it's not there. Because it's an object that you can actually see in because of its light. It's close enough. So it was so small and so elusive that they called it it's not there. But so in principle, you could actually observe even an isolated neutron stars, but the vast majority, practically all, are seen because they are in binary systems or because somehow they, you can still see them while they're cooling, so in X-rays, not in optical light. So even if they're isolated, you would be able. And then you have pulsars, of course. So there is the neutron star rotates usually very fast. There are many different velocities, but they can be as small fractions of a second usually.
But they spin that fast.
Can spin very, very fast, most of them. And there is a type of neutron star which you call a pulsar that has at the poles this emission of particles that can emit radio and X-rays sometimes. And they are very precise clocks. Actually, they're the best clocks, and they are used as clocks. And so they have some so-called spin down. They can change their velocity, can change Especially, of course, if they're in binary stars, so there is an interaction.
Something affecting their
movement. But you can see them even if they're not in white dwarfs. But still, it's because of some particles.
That they're emitting.
At the poles, yeah, that they are these pulses while they rotate, and you see the poles of the stars or near the poles.
How many of these various phenomena are there? I keep hearing about more and more black holes, for example. How many black holes have we actually observed?
Stellar black holes?
Sure, as opposed
galactic
to the...
Galactic black holes, we observe many galaxies. We observe black holes or phenomena due to the black holes, the so-called active galactic nuclei of various types. So those are... in a very, very large number.
How many in our galaxy, for example?
In our galaxy, there is one, we think, at the center. That's an object of study of this group that got that obtained the Nobel Prize years ago for imaging the light around very close to the event horizon of the black hole in a nearby galaxy, M81. If you heard of it, you surely heard of it because it was a Nobel Prize occasion.
Sure.
And so, and actually one of the people involved in that discovery came, is a good friend of our, of the chancellor of our university, and she came and gave a talk recently.
How fortunate.
So we know about this black hole because this lady, Andrea Goetz, and the other collaborators discovered it. But and that's the supermassive black hole in our galaxy. But the stellar black holes, we don't know a very large number. We're talking about... I don't know what the population would be, but it's for our galaxy, it's of the order of only tens of objects. Now more with the gravitational waves, ones from other galaxies. And in other galaxies also, in every galaxy, there are some explosive phenomena in binary stars that are due to binary stars with a black hole. Sometimes they have bursts of light. And
they're actually pulling
because they
mass
pull of a sudden more
star.
Mass, and so you have bursts of radio light, X-rays, often also optical light. So you discover them, and I think in the biggest galaxy of our local group, which is M31 or Andromeda, I think they were observing more than. More phenomena per year recently. So there must be, hidden population of, but tens of thousands perhaps. So what we see is the peak of the iceberg. So the ones we know in our galaxy, when I say, tens, it's just because they're hard to discover.
When you say you see black holes at the center of a galaxy, would that be expected given that they're so extremely or can be so extremely powerful in terms of gravity that things that the galaxy would in fact spin around them?
Now, the galaxy doesn't exactly spin around them, but the objects that are closer to them spin around them, and that's how they were. That's how they are discovered. The gas spins around them, but it depends a lot on the type of galaxy, on the star formation history, on the mass of the central black hole. Some central black holes are practically inert. They are very hard to discover. But we think that in most galaxies there should be ones. Maybe in the very small dwarf galaxies, they don't seem to be common, but in larger galaxies, they seem to be extremely common. And there are even binary black holes, binary active galactic
nuclei. Two black holes side by side.
Yeah, probably from merging of galaxies, but they have been discovered two massive black holes with millions of, stellar masses side by side.
And we have seen, I think I've seen images of actually galaxies colliding So you're saying that's why there would be...
Yeah, we see images of galaxies colliding, and even our galaxy may collide one day with Andromeda.
Well, if we're lucky, things will be spread out far enough that everything will slide right through.
Yeah, but that would be after, maybe after the Sun has finished its life. And has become a white dwarf. So.
A few billion years, 5 billion years or so.
Yeah, I don't remember what the calculations predict, but I have to confess, but it's... We still have a lot of time.
Well, we have a little bit more time left in this hour, and we'll devote it to finding out more about black holes and neutron stars and white dwarfs when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Marina Orio, and we're finding out from her about black holes and neutron stars and white dwarfs, these three forms of extremely compact phenomena in the universe, each with a different approach to its development or decay. And one of those phenomena, decay, would be brought about, I suppose, if you had, say, a couple of neutron stars, these incredibly dense entities colliding. Does that happen?
It does happen, and we have, talking about astronomers in general, but they were detected by a very large collaboration and then by a thousand astronomers at least or more looking at the same place, area of the sky at the same time in 2017, because there are these gravitational wave experiments based on very precise lasers that detect these with an interferometry phenomenon and with the help of other similar devices on other places on Earth. So we have a larger sort of triangulation basis, right? To keep things simple, it's not exactly triangulation, but that's how you can try to see where the gravitational wave phenomenon comes from in the sky. But usually we have only a very large area of sky that we cannot pinpoint at a very precise place. So the very interesting thing is to try and find out electromagnetic radiation, find light in any of the wavelengths in which you observe the sky that goes from radio to gamma rays with everything in between. And in August of 2017, an event was detected that, as I said, this precise formula that we have from general relativity showed that could be due only to neutron stars. The masses were small enough that they had to be neutron stars. Now, from Earth, we are not sensitive to the colliding of white dwarfs, which should also be common. But for that, we would need to do this type of experiments from observatories from space, and there is one planned in the next years.
Those are to look for white dwarfs
colliding white dwarfs and other and also massive black holes at the center of galaxies colliding. We could go to the two extremes from space. We see the images, that show that they will collide, but we haven't massive black holes. The frequency is such that you have to go outside. Go in space with a special experiment to detect them.
But neutron stars.
Neutron stars and the neutron star and stellar black holes, or as I was saying, even black holes are 20, 30 solar masses that are the remnants of extremely massive stars of over 100 solar masses. Those we can detect from Earth, and the very three clever scientists received the Nobel Prize for that. But what happened in 2017 was that all the observatories from space and from Earth looked towards that region of the sky and with clever methods to try to narrow the area from which the signal may have come from. They were able to see a sort of supernova and with large explosions also in gamma rays. A very peculiar one that depends, a very peculiar explosion or supernova that depends on is due to the emerging of the two neutron stars, exactly like the phenomenon that had been detected in gravitational waves. So it happened exactly at the same time. So it's, of course, the same in the right area of the sky. And that discovery was awarded a Nobel Prize for a scientist who had predicted the theory, one who had coordinated the the huge collaboration, and another one who had it actually built. These objects are interesting and special because they can produce some of the elements, the heavy elements that we think they're produced only in the explosions of massive stars.
So what, from iron? Heavier than iron.
Yeah, the heavy ones, you know, but it was advertised as the discovery of the production of gold because gold is one of the elements that you cannot form in a supernova from the collapse of the core of a very massive star above its solar masses, but you can form it by the collision of two neutron stars, maybe gold, platinum.
Well, let's talk about gold and platinum a little bit.
Yes.
Earth obviously has deposits of gold and platinum. Where did they most likely come from? Collision of neutron stars,
right.
And then
yeah, we think so.
Circuitously through the sun, which then spun off.
Well,
the Earth?
So stars. There are several generations of stars, and stars re-emit their gas. In the interstellar medium, and from that new stars are formed. And actually, the most active star formation sites for, you know, second star formations are those where massive stars have exploded. And from there, you immediately form new stars. So it's a more rapid cycle. So obviously, all the elements on Earth have come from other generations of stars before the sun. So white dwarfs have a second life. If they are in binary stars, they start accreting material. They can trigger thermonuclear reactions in the on a shell above the white dwarfs. And they can even explode as novae, and in between have smaller explosions of light. But novae are really thermonuclear explosions on the surface. But what we know is that there are a number of supernovae that are extremely important because they are, we can relate their the way the luminosity decays to the actual absolute luminosity, and from that understand at what distance they are. So the faster they the luminosity goes down, the smaller the absolute luminosity is, and there is a clear relation in a certain optical wavelengths, say, that have been calibrated. And so we know the distance of these supernovae. We usually observe them in external galaxies, and we know the distance to these galaxies. But a way to determine the distance of galaxies is also to measure the redshift, the universe is expanding.
Right, the Doppler
and
shift.
And it was thought to be through the Doppler shift in these spectral lines due to the atomic transitions in the spectrum, you can determine that that a galaxy is moving, that the universe is expanding, at what velocity it's moving away from us. And from that, you determine the distance from us.
And is it moving even more quickly as you get out toward the edges?
As you go towards the edges, exactly. But now you have a second determination of the distance through the thermonuclear supernovae in those galaxies where they were observed. And so what was discovered, and the Nobel Prize was awarded in physics for this in 2011, it became apparent that the two distances do not coincide, as it is if there is some force pulling the universe apart.
Oh, that's
that we call dark energy.
Reassuring.
So, at some, although up to a certain distance, the distances of the through the redshift coincide with the distances through supernovae or other means, everything seems pretty well nailed down. When you go to the farthest galaxies, the two distances do not coincide. And the idea is, if the distance of the supernova is right, then the distance of the redshift is not right anymore. And what happens is that something is sort of pulling the universe apart. There is some other form of energy that we never thought about. And we now think that this dark energy is the major component of the universe. And it's more in terms of relativity, we talk about energy and mass as the same thing. And so the actual most of the mass of the universe, actually, we don't see because galaxies seem to be also rotating as if there is a lot of dark mass around them. That's in some galaxies, the vast majority.
We don't have a way of even indirectly observing dark energy and dark matter?
Dark matter, we do. There are experiments, there are observations, and there are several possibilities. One of them is of elusive particles that are called axions. That's a theory, a possibility that comes back in fashion every once in a while and is an object of study. But there is hope for, you know, for a relatively quick, who knows, but a relatively clear explanation of dark matter at some point, although it could be an effect due to other to the modification of relativity. There are also other speculations that say that dark matter doesn't actually exist. But most scientists do think that it exists, and it's not an effect of physics and mathematics that we don't that we have to understand in a different way. Otherwise, dark energy, we are still in the dark. But the way it was detected, it was discovered, is mainly through these thermonuclear supernovae that are due to exploding white dwarfs. And now the funny thing about white dwarfs that maybe I didn't mention is that why can they ignite nuclear burning again? We said they're not able to ignite nuclear burning again because they don't contract.
They can rejuvenate.
They don't have the mass. When the white dwarf cools, it becomes like a crystal with only conductions of electrons in it, and it becomes so cold at some point that nuclear reactions can be ignited only because of a certain density. It's called a so-called picno-nuclear, not thermonuclear regime. Picno means density. So they have the. If the white dwarf can accrete material or can merge, most possibly this happens because it merges with another white dwarf in a binary system. If the white dwarf accretes material or accretes another white dwarf, the peculiarity of white dwarfs and also neutron stars is that the more massive they are, the smaller the radius is, the more compact they become. And so white dwarf that accretes matter or merges with another white dwarf can ignite this explosive carbon phenomenon, but it can do it only in a very small range of density and mass. It is very close to the mass to collapse into a neutron star. So it's a little bit of the mystery of a mystery as to why we have this thermonuclear supernovae, because you need such a fine tuning that most of them actually may just collapse into neutron stars instead of exploding.
Well, clearly you have your work cut out for you, Marina Orio, when it comes to solving some of these mysteries of the universe. You will never run out of them. Always something to investigate. It'll be interesting to hear what your next discovery is. But thanks for sharing some of them with us during this conversation.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour. Our engineer, Tom Blaine, and this is University of the Air. Little darling,